Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, Rangers. It's me, Jackie Cation. Welcome to the Dork Forest. It's 2024. Let's do this. Here's the credits, of course. Mike Rickberg sang that song at the beginning, and he wrote that song, and he sang it with Sarah Cohen, his wife. And he will sing the Mexican Hat Dance at the end of the program. Also, Patrick Brady, still putting this together. Video, audio, all of it. He's amazing. So, and Vilmos doing JackieCationStore.com. Squarespace is doing the regular Jackie Cation page, and I'm thinking of moving the Dork Forest and DorkForest.com away from WordPress because it's driving me nuts. But those are the credits. But if you go to JackieCation.com, you can get Dork Forest merch. You can get my stand-up merch. You can get my stand-up CDs and DVDs, which you'd have to have devices for those. You can also see videos and find out any number of things. I have another podcast called The Jackie and Laurie Show, but The Dork Forest is the flagship. 18th year, we're doing it, you guys. You can go to my Bandcamp or my YouTube for extra content. Please donate, is what I'm saying. It's 2024, and I think we've been in this long enough. Why don't you guys, everybody send me $100? That's what I'd like you to do. You can PayPal me. There's links all over the pages. You can Venmo me at Jackie Cation. You can find me at a stand-up show and hand me a sweaty wad of 20s. Do something. But I love doing the show. I would love to make some money, is what I'd like to do. In other news, I'm sure there's more things that I should talk about, but I can't think of them. But let's listen to who's going to dork out about something, because that's my favorite part. Thanks for listening, you guys. You're all great. Let's get into the show. We're doing it. Hello, Jackie Cation here in my garage. Very nice. That's right. It's like 88 degrees here. And I'm with Jeff Cerulli, who New York comic, new special called Live at the Bomb Shelter. It's going to be on Amazon and Apple and all these things. It's at Jeff Cerulli, I think, on the Instagram. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, you got it right.
Okay. Yeah. So if I say we're doing it again, just hang up. Just hang up on me. And so your dorkdom, though, is so funny because I've had so many people who love a documentary and none of them like the same documentaries. Mm-hmm. Because there's enough documentaries out there that there are many episodes of The Dork Forest available. So you picked, I was like, just send me like five that you really liked. And you picked a couple of sports ones.
Yeah.
And some people pick a couple of murder ones. And so this is kind of interesting. This is fun that you pick sports ones. Is the hoop? I assume Hoop Dreams is a sports one.
Yeah, I thought of it because I kind of hate where the documentary world is now. And
are
I did a doc.
Are these ones older?
These are kind of older that I sent you. I did a doc. I've done two docs, and the doc world. So I made a doc. The doc that I made with, you know, Barry Rothbart, fellow comedian. He's out in L.A.
Yep.
Yeah. So he's one of my best friends.
Okay.
You need to know that off the bat. That's one of my dorkdoms.
Right. It's how great Barry is. Yes.
Yeah. So we're longtime friends at that point, probably like 6-7 years. And we did a doc called Hungry Together. That's the poster in the background right there with the hot dog. And
okay.
It was just like a different world doing docs. We were filming this in like 2011-12, and it came out in 2013. And it
Did
was
you
like
do it with your iPhones. That's what it was. That's
no,
how it was.
But that's kind of okay. Was like starting to like, oh, you could just film with your iPhone. I mean, like Sean Baker, who's like my favorite director, did a film that was just the iPhone Tangerine. Like, it's just like, you know, we've moved past that, but it's like the iPhone thing is so interesting. Like Steven Soderbergh, what's his name? Steven Soderbergh. Yeah, I'm saying it right. The guy he is like a really successful director, and he will just do different shit. And then one of his movies was on an iPhone.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's just like, but he's using like kind of lenses on it. It's kind of misleading. It's not just like, and he has
right,
like,
right. He's not just picking up his iPhone and going, all right, wait, actually turn around because the sun's behind me. I'm sure he's got gear. There's gear happening.
Yeah.
Yes, for sure. So what's changed? What do you think has changed in the documentary industry that makes you kind of go, get off my lawn.
Yeah.
It was better when it started.
So I gave you a few docs that were kind of like, that I think were big docs. They were kind of groundbreaking in some way. And they kind of meant something to me as just like a viewer. So my issue with the doc world now, so when we did Hungry, it was a competitive eating doc. By the way, it wasn't on like something like Noble. Like, that's not what I'm talking about, that it needs...
No, there's
like,
a picture of a hot dog behind you.
that documentaries need to be about something quote-unquote important. It can be about whatever. But what I think that different about now, so when we did it in 2013, it was such a novelty. Nobody was like... The general mainstream was not watching documentaries. There'd be like two that were popular a year, and that was it. And now... where like Netflix gets involved and it's like a big business, it kind of just fucking ruins it. And it's like a tale as old as time. And then now it's just like so many of the Netflix docs are just paint by number. Hey, what's a true crime story that happened 30 years ago that we could, you know, make some money off that we could do. And it's not to say there's not good true crime docs, but it's like the majority now are just this.
Right. And I'm sure you just have to sort of like all television or all media, you have to go, well, I have to take a sort of a comb and go through and figure out where the ones that are good and the ones that I really like, right? Like, I mean, I love a nature documentary and some of them are dumb, but there was a documentary I saw, which you would think is just rude to say because we're talking about animals. I was like, no, I didn't like that picture, that winged whatever. But no, there was like a weird documentary on PBS about robot. Oh, this is interesting. Last episode was about robots and I forgot about this. They're robot, like they make robot fish that can integrate with the different schools of fish. Like they have a robot hammerhead shark. It's called Spy in the Midst or something like that. And they follow like a robot stingray, a robot, the thing with the, remember in Nemo where the light? They sent one, a robot down to meet other, and then they could film those fish. Are you looking it up?
Yeah, I'm looking it up.
In the hopes? Right.
Yeah.
But it was really cool, but there's a lot, cattail. And there's a lot of documentaries. There's so many documentaries. That there's obviously it's just easy to just do paint by numbers kind of thing now.
Yeah. And that's what it is now, where it's so much of that. Like it's now that it became mainstream, it's like, here's the way we're going to do it. So most docs, I would say 90% of the docs on Netflix are like pretty much spotty like that, where it's okay. Like, it's just kind of a true crime thing. We're going to just do some interviews and we're going to make it five parts because that's, you know, it's more profitable and, you know, everything's got to end in a cliffhanger, even if it's not that compelling, like we just have to make it. And this is the world we're at now.
Like documentaries used to be movies and now they're more series. Now they're like, there's some documentary called Women of Rock. And I've tried to watch it a couple of times and I've started it at the beginning before rock and roll was invented. And you're like, wait a minute, these are just women. And these are just women musicians. And that's fine. But I think they called it Women of Rock because it, you know, they're like, just wait, Janis Joplin's coming up, man. It's going to be okay. Pat Benatar's coming. And but it was very interesting. I mean, I didn't know about Mavis What's-Her-Face and I didn't know about this other, you know, I don't know about a bunch of gospel singers and all these people. But what year, I'm just going to go down, The Imposter, Bart Layton.
Okay.
What is that?
Here's what's funny about that doc. So that's a true crime doc, but this guy is like a master. This guy, Bart Layton, he's a British director. So I saw this film when I was in the editing lab making my film. Like it was the summer of 2013 and we're editing Hungry. We're in the lab, we're doing it. And then I remember I saw this doc with my sister. And I was like, I'm making absolute shit. Like, this is this is so high quality.
Don't feel that. Don't go there.
I was like, compared to what I'm doing, which again, I love Hungry.
You were just blown away by how great it was. What made it great, though?
Okay, here's what made it great. So I love Hungry. It's the best project I did, and I have so much passion for it. And we were following people around this world, and it just felt like it was like, man, this guy, wow, he could tell a story. So basically what he did is, first of all, to make, there's a few elements with like what makes a good documentary, right? And if you get the villain, you got yourself a good doc. If you get the quote unquote bad guy,
okay,
you got something, because now you're going to be maybe sympathetic to this person. They're going to tell the story. So he has the bad guy in that doc. First off the bat, basically this family in Texas, their kid goes missing. And then this guy, on the other side of the world, says he's their missing kid. Clearly not, but they take him in. And then the story is like, well, did they kill their kid? Did they not? And he's implying that they did, but he's also like a pathological liar. So you kind of don't know what the fuck's going on, but it's like, this guy tells the story really well. He has the family, he has him. This guy's telling it the whole time. The way he like interviews this guy is like, the family is shot at a certain angle, but this guy's the only one that's shot like head on talking to the camera, while everyone else is like talking off screen. Like you're doing interview, you're talking to the director. He's the only
one
to
make it more interesting.
Yeah, he's looking directly on the screen while everyone else is talking off. That was like a neat little trick. He interjects him, like he does reenactments where he interjects him in different scenes that work really well. Okay. And I'm just like, that's how you do a true crime doc. This is like at a really high level. That's how you do true crime. He also did a narrative thing he called American Animals, which was...
another movie?
It was a movie. It was a narrative. It was about these kids who they were trying to steal artwork from, I believe it was a college, and it had actors in it. It was like Evan Peters and actors. But the trick was he got the kids who did it. I'm saying kids, they were in their 20s, and he interjects them into the movie. So the trailer doesn't have that. So you see the trailer, you think it's just a straightforward, like, oh, these kids were trying to steal like artwork. Barry Keegan, who's an amazing actor, who's in Banshees and Inisherin and Killing of a Sacred Deer, he's in it. Like, the trick of the movie kind of is you don't know that. And then when you watch it, he actually like, he'll put the like Evan Peters character in the same scene as the character he's playing. And they're like in a car together and they're talking. And that sounds like kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
But he just knows how to fucking do it. And he makes it really compelling.
So he literally tells he's good at telling the story in the documentary. And that's what, like, when you say that he had the bad guy in The Imposter, the imposter was the bad guy, not the bad guy who stole their kid, the bad guy who said, I'm your kid.
Yeah, we don't know you don't know exactly what happened, and you're never going to know.
And you're never going to know.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, well, you could buy that the family was so traumatized by it, they were just happy that they're like, oh, our son is back. I mean, you could also buy that they killed him, but there's no real evidence for that. He's the bad guy because he's also done it before where he's a pathological liar. And then at the end, it's crazy. He's got like a family of his own now, they say.
Weird.
Yeah.
Weird.
It's like, crazy.
Nice button on your, crazy. I mean,
there's an art form to it. That's been lost. There's an art. Like, that's one thing that's lost too. These Netflix docs are like a lot of we're just going to tell the story. And it doesn't have an artistic flair, whereas like that's what I think is missing from the dark world. It's like the story should be told in a compelling way. And it's like, you know, it's very informational now.
The documentaries that I've seen, there was one creepy documentary I saw that I didn't know was a documentary until about three quarters of the way through it from the 90s. It was about three brothers who were on a farm. Mm-hmm. And they all lived in a bus, and one of them dies, and they all share the same bed. And it's about these three brothers who have lived together. They were all in their 70s, 60s and 70s and 80s. And one of them dies. And so the documentary is about, did the two brothers kill the third brother? Were these three brothers incestuous? Why were they all sleeping in one bed for 70 years? And what the hell? And, if it resolved, I never got that memo. All I remember is just a light going off three quarters of the way through the movie going, oh, these aren't actors. This is a real story about three creepy old dudes who may or may not have enjoyed each other's company a little too much from their childhood.
What was this called?
It was like Three Brothers. I wish I could. I wish I had more information for you, but because you love documentaries, and it's from the 90s.
Yeah.
So,
I'll look it up. I don't. It could be a lot of things, but that's really interesting. So you don't know if you don't know what happened.
No, I don't know what happened, and it was. I went with a friend of mine, Big Tall Larry, who I haven't seen in decades. But we neither one of us knew what the hell it was until Three Identical Strangers. Was that it?
No, that was from a few years ago. That was the Three Identical Strangers. They were separated at like birth, and you know, that was a good one. See, that one was good.
Amazing.
That was a recent doc that was like well done. That's true crime that has like an artistic flair to it. And it also is like a compelling story. That was a good doc.
Okay. And then there was a farm and they lived in a bus. hey, you guys, welcome to the Dork Forest where Jeff and I Google things. I can't imagine. Yeah, there's no way that it's that. So the other documentary I own several documentaries.
What do you own?
I am not a gay lady, but for some reason I own The Celluloid Closet.
Okay.
Did you ever see that?
I didn't see that. It's good.
The Celluloid Closet is essentially the history of how homosexuality is depicted in film.
Good.
From the beginning of film.
Interesting.
And it's just a lot of clips from a lot of different movies. And there's a narrative and there's no, and it's just informative. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't, you know, but what it did do was it makes me aware whenever, because I watch a lot of mystery television. Mm-hmm. Whenever there's lesbians, they're usually the murderers.
Oh, interesting.
It's usually some sort of love story gone wrong. And she's like, but I loved her, so I killed her. And you're like, are we still doing this? And when they don't do it, it's always surprising. What it is, I notice it now.
I can think of a few off the top of my head from the 90s that involve some sort of lesbian killer. Single white female, one. This,
right.
Do you remember Bound with Jennifer Tilly?
I never saw it, but I remember that.
That one. And this movie, Mercy. That's three off the top of my head that were like real HBO. Like these were all on HBO.
Right.
All the time. Well, that's something else I could talk about. All like the movies when I was growing up, they were on HBO all the time that I watched.
Just over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting what cable did. They like to show things just to make sure you saw Beastmaster. they just wanted to show it to you 26 times in a 2-week period. And it was hard to turn
Sands
off
movie?
Eventually. I think so.
I think he just passed recently.
I'm in the part of show business that doesn't know who anybody is. So what I'm excited for here is right. And then the other documentary I saw that I own is Dogtown and Z-Boys.
Great. Yeah.
Which is a skateboarding documentary because I always wanted to skateboard, but I was unwilling. The one time I skateboarded, I broke my wrist. And so I was like, maybe that's a different life. And but I do like it it's funny about Dogtown and Z-Boys because they talked about how poor they were and how they lived in this crummy town in Southern California called Venice. But they were poor in the late 60s, early 70s in Los Angeles, where everyone had a camera with real film that they could shoot. And you were like, how poor are you? This doesn't sound poor. And, but the footage was beautiful and they tried to take that documentary and turn it into something real.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't work out as well. I thought, I mean, I like it when
they made a narrative of it. Yeah. They
yeah.
Did.
Yeah. They just made a regular movie out of it that ended up not being as good, which, there's that cat.
He wants dinner.
And he wants in.
Yeah. Once it's around five, he just will just keep bothering me until I feed him.
Well, let's talk about Hoop Dreams. What is that? Steve James.
Yeah. So this was like, I think one of like, if you're talking about like the early, I mean, documentary has been going around like forever one way or another, but like the kind of like modern era, that was probably like the biggest, because this guy, Steve James, followed these two guys around when they were young who were going to try to make the NBA, which is very hard. As you know, yep. It's very hard.
Sure, that it doesn't sound easy.
Yeah, so neither of them make it. But it's like, I think it was like 94, but he filmed them for like 4 or 5 years. So it was like so much footage. It was basically like reality show style of like interviewing and just following. And it was just very like acclaimed and kind of like, again, they didn't complete the task. So it wasn't like they made the NBA. So it was a lot about inner city Chicago. It was a lot about these families. It was just like a real personal story. So I think at the time, like that was a really groundbreaking documentary.
It sounds like kind of like slice of life because they didn't get in. And to follow, and how old were these young men? Were they like 15 or 16?
Yeah, they were like middle school to high school. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And they,
yeah. So,
yeah. And it was long too. It was like 3 hours. It was a long movie. And I remember watching it when I was a kid and, you know.
And just being compelled because it's.
Yeah.
Because the thing is if you watch, people have, like, I don't know what you wanted to be when you were 13. I wanted to be a forest ranger. Weird. I have a podcast called The Dork Forest. My listeners identify as rangers. So, but I wanted to be a forest ranger. And, if someone would have followed me around.
Yeah.
Like, what did you want to be in junior high and in middle school?
I did want to always try comedy.
Oh, really?
I was a kid. So that worked out in that sense of like, that's something I did pursue. But obviously, like, I wanted to do something. Like, I wanted to play baseball. That wasn't going to fucking happen. Like, I was really good at baseball in my town on my little league team. And then when I got to like eighth grade, I realized it's like, oh, I'm not actually like, I'm like fine, you know.
Right. There's another level. Yeah. Yeah.
And NBA, I knew that was not going to happen. But obviously, every like boy wants to play sports. And then I don't know if I think I was very into comedy. I remember New Year's Eve when the HBO would play comedy all night. And
okay.
I would watch those, and yeah, it's something I wanted to do. Other stuff I don't know. I never really
thought
ahead.
When did you start doing stand-up? Did you start
young? I tried it when I was in college. Yeah, I dabbled when I was in college, just like trying it. Like I did a few bringer shows. And then when I was like later in my mid-20s, I moved to the city. I'm from a half an hour from the city, so it's not like I moved far. But I moved to the city with my buddy, and then I was like doing it since then. And then I always felt the push and pull between like film and comedy and, you know.
Is Live at the Bomb Shelter your special? Is that your first special?
Yeah.
Congratulations, man.
Thank
That's
you.
Awesome.
Yeah. It just felt good to do it because it's just like I didn't have anything of record for so long and I'm doing comedy for such a long time that I just was like, I got to do something. Like I got to just have something to just put out there because I haven't done that. I owe it to myself.
I got two words for you, Jeff.
What is
passive
that?
Income. What you're going to want to get involved in, as I talked to a lot of comics who are like, I have met comics who have been doing it, probably not as long as me, but almost, who are like, I don't have any albums. And you're like, you're killing me because you're just sort of leaving money on the table and you're never going to do those jokes again because eventually you get bored and you're like, you can't even remember them. So, I mean, obviously every joke in the world is now being captured on reels. So even every premise, it's nice. So it's different now, but I would encourage. So it's interesting. You wanted to, but if someone came to you when you were like 13 or 14 and said, you want to do stand up, and granted, if someone points a camera at you and says, you want to do this thing, it does light a fire under you. I bet you that in Hoop Dreams, it made them play more basketball. It made them more interested. Like they wanted to play basketball, and I'm sure they were interested in getting into the NBA. But what did they end up doing? Does it say, or how were their grades? Aunt Jackie would like to know.
How are their grades? Yeah, I know one of them got hurt, and that really killed it for him.
Right.
And the other one kind of, I think he played like semi-pro in some leagues, but I don't know, like, I don't know what they did. What's interesting is there was a follow-up. There was a documentary called Subject that came out recently that was all about people who were the subject of a documentary.
It's, oh, that's kind of fascinating.
It's, yeah, it's more interesting in theory than the actual doc, because the actual doc itself is fine. But it
good
has
idea.
It has the two guys from Hoop Dreams. It has the guy from like The Staircase, who was the guy who was accused of killing his wife. Do you know that story about The Staircase?
No.
HBO did a narrative where Colin Firth played him, but basically his first wife died. She fell down a staircase. And then his second wife died. She fell down a staircase. And then the second one, they're like, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Too much falling.
So he went to jail for a while, and then he actually got out. So they talked to him. They talked to his daughter, who was like, basically the daughter was like, never be in a documentary. They take advantage of you, and you don't, you know, it's like what this did to my family is terrible.
Well, the thing is it's a documentary feels like a sort of a more respectable version of reality television, right?
Yeah.
Where supposedly you go in knowing what you're gonna want to come out with, but you can't know what you're gonna come out, especially if you are doing something like Hoop Dreams or, The Imposter. It's interesting that The Imposter was willing to be in the movie.
Here's also what's different now than back then. Even when The Imposter was made in 2000, 13, it came out. So they were filming in probably like 11, 12. Okay. It's a different world. So especially in the 90s, you don't really know what to think of it. Now everyone's like media trained now, right? Everyone is like media trained because we have cameras on our phones from like day one now, young people growing up. So like, what you see, and this is another problem with the doc world now, is it's a lot of celebrity driven pieces that control it, which is like technically like unethical, right? Like Ken Burns spoke about it with the Michael Jordan documentary. The Michael Jordan documentary, The Last Dance, it was fun. Like it was a good time. I enjoyed it. But at the end of the day, it was PR for Michael Jordan. It's not getting made unless he has his production company in it so he can get final say the edit. He's going to control how he's looked. And that's the deal. You're not getting it. You're not getting the 5-part fun, nostalgic Michael Jordan doc, unless he gets say in it. And like I remember my wife loves Taylor Swift. We watched the Taylor Swift doc a few years ago, and I was like, this is just PR for her. They had one scene where she was like, oh, I want to speak out against Donald Trump, and it's like a big thing. And I'm like, this is such fucking garbage. Right.
But I'm 24 years old.
Yeah, it's like produced shit. But that's kind of what the world is. So it's like back then, it's like, I don't think you're thinking about that. And it's like, I was trying to get a doc off the ground, and it was about this kind of, it was basically about this, this kind of scandal, like this pyramid scheme, and like athletes were involved. So I was talking to some people that got like ripped off by it. And their first thing was like, how much will I get paid for this? And it's like, I'm just one person now. Like, I don't have a production company involved. Like, it's like people are just media savvy. It's just like, well, what am I going to get for it? Whereas people didn't ask that 10 years ago. It was just like, all right, you're making a doc. All right, I'm either going to do it or I'm going to not. But I feel like now everyone is like, what do I get? And the Subject documentary got into that a little bit. And some of it, like, I get it. If you're going to be in a doc and you're not going to have control over it, right. I get you want something for it. Like, I do get it.
Right. There has to be. Right. It definitely feels like whoever the subject of the documentary is should make a great deal of money, especially if it blows up. Like, the person telling the story is essentially, like in reality television, the people who are telling the story in reality television are the editors, because supposedly there's no writers, right? So in a documentary, if you're directing, the director and the editor are telling that story. The people who it's about are not telling the story. They might think that they are. Because I know that I had a friend of mine a big director wanted to do a documentary about her.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, I can't. I'm trying to also live my life.
Yeah.
You want to just follow me around and watch me write a new hour. but also not, you're going to watch me not write 2 hours, right? I mean, the writing of a new hour of stand-up comedy means you've written 3 hours of stand-up comedy and 2 hours of it isn't good. And she's like, I'm not psyched that you are going to get that. And he's like, no, I would be super flattering. It would just all be because I love you so much. And she was like, yeah, this feels like more work than, and he's like, it'll be great PR. It'll be really, really good PR. And she's like, I don't care. It's not that I don't need the PR. I probably do. Mm-hmm. I just don't want, this seems more effort at this point. You know, like, I think that there's, like, Rodney Dangerfield, like, there's comedy documentaries. There's so many comedy documentaries. And my favorite one was a weird, nobody made any money. And
what's the guy that?
It's called You Have to Kill, and it's on Amazon. And
You Have to Kill?
You Make Sure You Kill, or it's a You Have to Kill. It's with Chad Daniels, Pete Lee, and Tom Segura.
Okay. And remember this.
And they go to I Need You to Kill.
Yeah, I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is Lewis Lee, the guy who owns Acme Comedy Company in Minneapolis, my home club. He was like, hey, and Josh Weinstein, who goes by, I think, Josh Elvis Weinstein. He was one of the creators of Freaks and Geeks or whatever. And but he directed it. And they all went to Singapore and Hong Kong. And I had just gotten back from Hong Kong. And I was like, well, can I be in it? And Lewis is like, no, I'm just bringing these two guys, these three guys. We're going to party. You were just in Hong Kong. And I was like, there's 11 million people in Hong Kong. I'm going to bet most of them haven't seen me. Sure. And but I love that documentary to some extent, even though there's not much to it. What I liked about it was they showed them the three guys doing the same set in different rooms and how it was received. Was one.
I remember this doc. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Tom Segura at the end of it, there's a twist at the end of it that is actually very, very funny, where he does Pete and Chad's opening jokes because he goes first. And Pete has a small meltdown and Chad can't stop laughing. And so Pete's like, he took my opening joke. And Chad's like, do a different joke. And Pete's like, yeah, but that was my set. I have that. My set is organized. And so it was a really compelling, great scene. And Tom Segura didn't tell them that he was going to do it.
Sure.
And I don't even know if he told Lewis. I think he told Josh. And that was about it. And he might not have even told Josh. I think it's something about doing a documentary and just sort of it being in reality. A reality kind of situation.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And again, it's like you're talking about no one made money on that. And it's like technically it's always been unethical to pay the subject because then they're like working for you and then it's like they're on your payroll and then you're supposed to say, but also like, is that a dodge that like you just don't want to pay? Like, it's a complicated question, but that's what I want to see more of. Like, I want to see more of docs like that are following people around. They're a little more like organic how it happens. Like that's like what I want to see more of. And when I see a doc like that, I get excited that I'm like, oh, this feels like a throwback. It's not just like an informational true crime doc.
Right. Right.
That's why we're here to talk about this. It's like what I.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what you want to see. Yeah. And is Grizzly Man Werner Herzog?
Oh my God. So Werner Herzog is another like legendary, like documentary filmmaker. He's like this German, like he's done a million things. And Grizzly Man was interesting because it was about this guy, Timothy Treadwell, who it was like, he wanted to be like an actor and he felt like he was going to get the role of like Woody Harrelson in Cheers and he didn't get it. He came close and that kind of, it seemed like that's what, like put him off the edge and he kind of just like kind of loses it one way or another. And he becomes this guy who just like I forget where, but he just hangs out with bears in like the woods.
Okay.
And he would just do these videos and he was just hanging out with bears. So Werner Herzog like does a documentary on him and he's just getting close to the bears. He's like hanging out with the bears. And then at the end, he gets killed by a bear, him and his fiance.
I think I could have called that. Holy, yeah. Of course. Wait, so is he literally hanging out with grizzly bears in like Alaska or wherever grizzly bears still live?
Yeah, he's not like super close to them, but he's like close enough. And then at the end, so I always had the theory where I was like, did he do it on purpose? My mind went to like, all right, man, this guy was hanging out with bears for like years. I felt like he kind of knew what he was doing. And I felt like he just kind of romanticized, like, wouldn't it be great?
Suicide by bear?
Die by bear. Yeah. And his fiance died. And I remember the ending, spoiler alert, they don't show the footage because he would film everything. He would film all the stuff. But I believe they play the audio, which,
oh God,
the thing that's jarring about it is like, we're all used to the screams in a horror movie.
Yeah.
And this is like different of like the woman screaming where it's like legitimately screaming for your life. It's fucking terrible. That always stuck with me, but it was like an interesting doc and it was a good character study. And Werner Herzog is amazing.
How did Werner Herzog get the rights, or were they in it together? Like he heard about it and he was
family.
I'll make a movie out of this. And
yeah.
And the guy's like, I'm filming everything. You can have it all.
I think the family like gave him permission.
Oh, the family.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And Werner Herzog was so famous at that. Like once you get a resume and you've, you know, done this and that and that, like people will talk to you. Me, no one will talk to, but Werner Herzog people will talk to.
I am a very well-kept secret in show business. So looking forward to, what about American movie? Chris Smith.
Okay. So, this is another doc that I gave you just of something that meant something to me. And this was a doc that came out in the mid 90s. And this Chris Smith's gone on to do a lot of things.
Right.
But he was filming this guy in Wisconsin who was trying to make a movie. And he was trying to make a horror movie and he kind of can't get out of his own way. And eventually he makes the short film and it kind of just like, it's real slice of life. Like this guy's kind of incompetent, but you kind of root for him. And he's trying to make a horror movie. He's got this guy, Mike, as a sidekick, who's kind of a character. And, okay. And you just kind of, again, it's like the Hoop Dream style of just, you're just following these people along. And he's like, he's trying so hard, but he's just kind of incompetent. And eventually, yeah, he makes his short movie.
Okay. So he makes the movie and I feel like there were a couple of documentaries that came out of Wisconsin. There was some guy who was accused of murder and who might not have done it. And there was a weird documentary series on that. But that felt kind of contrived. American movie sounds familiar as well.
Probably like 97 this came out. 97.
Late 90s. Yeah. And he ended up making his movie, but it never went anywhere to some extent just because it was just okay. Or
yeah, I don't know. It was like schlocky, like low budget horror movie. Like that's not, okay. It's not going to really go anywhere.
Right. Right.
But the town came together at the end. They watched it and, you know, he accomplished his goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's, what made you like, documentaries in the beginning?
Interesting. Like just, this is the thing. It was interesting. Like when I'm a kid, when I'm younger and it's the 90s, like it's a novelty. I would watch them with my sister. My sister's 6 years older than me. And we would just like, it was like when you'd go to the video store and you'd be like, oh, let's watch a documentary. It was just very kind of offbeat. And we would like American movie I saw with my sister. Hoop Dreams, no. But I remember that I saw with my sister. And yeah, just like watching these and like, I mean, you know how it used to be. I remember Blair Witch, how that was marketed, and it was like, oh, is that a documentary? It was just like
right.
Like you can't fool people. You can't fool people like that now. But in 1999, you just all you had to say is like, we found this footage, and it's like, oh, what is this? And it looked like kind of believable, and it was scratchy footage, and it was like
it had some realism.
Yeah,
yeah, because it was all bouncing up and down.
Mm-hmm.
What was Now, I just to, before we talk about your other dorkdom, and I think we have time. It's unless you want to talk about other docs, but I do want to know about that the hot dog eating, one you did.
That was the one I did two documentaries. I did one called Tasteless on an old joke book that this woman wrote that like it was popular in the 80s, and it's just interviews. I just interviewed some comics, and that came out like 5 years ago.
And who was it?
It was called Tasteless. Do you remember Truly Tasteless Jokes? It was like a joke book from the 80s. Yeah. So this woman, Ashton Applewhite, wrote it. So we interviewed her, and it was wasn't Who'd You Think. And we tried to talk about comedy, where it's gone. And like, I just didn't want it to be a, like, why can't we say the things we used to be able to say documentary? I wanted to like have some smart people in it and have like an interesting discussion about like things have changed, but you can still do comedy, but you know, it's always changing, but it's, you know, why are we saying, you know, why are you doing it? Like, and you know,
when did Tasteless come out?
2017.
Okay. Okay. So after, you know, when the narrative, after the narrative had started about cancel culture and,
yeah,
and they're like, oh, you can't say anything anymore, man. And you're like, turns out you can, and you get to say it in Madison Square Garden. Anyway, so you can say whatever you want. It's the only punishment is that you get a shittier fan base.
Yeah.
That's all. It's just now you're just being followed around by a bunch of douchebags who think that you should get to do whatever you want to do without regard to humanity.
The thing about it is there's such a difference between the comics that like Anthony Jeselnik, he has like a nuance. Yeah, he has a nuance to him. Where, and he'd all like, if you hear him in interviews, he's the first one to be like, yeah, people can get mad at what you say, like, grow up, like, what do you want?
Yeah,
but like, Anthony Jeselnik has like a nuance to him, and he's like kind of winking at the audience, or like, even like Shane Gillis. I think Shane Gillis is funny and he's kind of smart enough to know what he's doing. Whereas, like, some of the other stuff that you were just like referring to is just like, why can't I say whatever I want? Why couldn't, like, it's just like, yeah, but like, what are you doing up there? Like, what are you
right.
Like, what
there
is this?
When ironic racism became something that people were doing in the late 90s, I saw it first, Sarah Silverman and Zach Galifianakis both. Mm-hmm. And they both did it. They did it well.
Yeah.
And it was funny. I mean, I laughed and I knew that, and you could tell, like, Jeselnik last night did a joke about how the voting age is 18. And he thinks that it should be 16, and he should. And if you are allowed to drive a car, you think he's going to say they should be allowed to vote, but he says I should be allowed to have sex with that person. Yeah. And so it was this very, very dark joke about statutory rape that was just peak Jeselnik.
Yeah.
And the audience were just like, oh, ha, because you know he's not.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know him well, but I know him well enough that I know that he's actually not the kind of person who takes advantage of children.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
Right. He's an adult man. He's not, he has his own life. He's kidding. And so, but guys like him and like Zach and Sarah Silverman, they were like, oh, we can do this. This is, I'm a bit ironic. And you're like, yeah, but you're not good at it. And then it was, and then one step further away from that, it's just bad guys going, mm-hmm. I get to say this. And you're like, oh, I'm
tired. You know what I'm noticing is back, calling women bitches. I'm hearing that in people's stand-ups and I'm like, why? First of all, Chappelle does it. And there's a few others that I'm like, when did this like become like mainstream? Have you noticed it too?
Well, I think it started because women sort of took it back and just sort of were calling each like, other bitches a bunch.
But when women say it, it's like, yo, bitch, blah, 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 blah. I don't know. Like different. I don't know. I feel like it's, I don't know. Yeah.
It's very different. It's coming from inside the house.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's not, it's still not my favorite, but I get it because I was called Karen a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just say this about the employee who called me Karen. She wasn't entirely wrong. And I know what she was. I know where it came from. I'm not the hero of that story. But I will say that to call people Karen, it's such an arbitrary word.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what she means. It isn't anything. Like, I know shittier people named Brenda. You know, like I know, like I've met a Colleen that you could bury headfirst in the sand and I'd be all right with that. But so the fact that Karen got turned into this pejorative just noun, and it reminded me that I don't, when I insult people, and I try desperately not to, Jeff, I try to pause before I snap because I do stand-up comedy. And I've done it for a long time. And if I'm going to hurt your feelings, I'm genuinely going to hurt your feelings. It isn't okay. It's this actually, I'm good at it. It's not fair. So I try to pause and go, don't. But I'm not going to call you a name. I'm literally, but if I do say something horrible, I'm going to say something so enormously specific. I'm not going to call you the N-word. I'm not going to make fun of your race or religion or how tall you are or how fat you are. I'm literally going to hurt your feelings.
Yeah.
And it's not okay. And but Karen, that's just shitty writing. So as far as I'm concerned, and so I would prefer that she did just said, well, get out of here, jackass, because you're being a jackass, because or a stronger word. But Karen, you can get away with saying it because I mean, and literally she called me Karen and I stepped back and I was like, well, I think that's my cue to ask for the manager. And then, which again, not the hero of the story. And then she invoked the other power that you have when you're in retail, which is to say, I'll go get her and then never return. So good for her. Good for her.
I call everyone maniac and I call everyone a maniac. I like the term maniac. It can be used both ways. I have friends that I can use it in a loving way. Like, dude, you're a maniac. Just like they're kind of too much. And also like you're kind of just insane. You're a maniac. So I was in the supermarket today. Kind of reminds me of your story. And I was getting a few things. And there was an older woman who I was waiting at the point where you wait. And there was only one register open. But there was someone there she couldn't see. And she was like going nuts on me. She was like, come on. She was just like going nuts. Go. And she's like, you got it. Blah, 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 blah. And then I go, there's someone there. And she's like, no. And then I walk over and I see there's someone there. And I go, yeah, there's someone there. And then she's still like saying stuff. And I go, yo, you're being a fucking maniac about this. And then she flew off the handle to me. And I was like, yeah, you're going like, you're being insane about this. There was someone there. She's like, well, I got to go to work. And then she goes, this is why I work with animals because they're much nicer than people. And I'm like, because I called you
were
fucking
mean to me.
Yeah. I'm like, you started it. And then I'll tell you what didn't land. So then they opened up another register and we're both checking out at the same time. And this didn't land. I said this as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
She was like still saying stuff. And I say to the guy, I go, you got to kick this woman out. Get her out of here. Like this is a joke. And then I think the guy took me seriously and she was like, don't fuck with me. And I was like, all right, that's one of those things in my head. It's clearly a joke. I don't want her to get kicked out, but I'm like, get her out. Look at the way she's talking. And she's like, don't fuck with me. And then I'm like, oh, nobody knows I'm joking except me. And then I just left. But I wasn't serious, like, you know, but I'm like she flew off the handle.
I like that you were in an actual public situation, but because Jeff Cerulli is a stand-up comic, ladies and gentlemen,
I was like,
I was just riffing in the end. I'm just trying to lighten the mood.
My second miss there. One other time was with my wife where I accused her to the woman of stealing something. And my wife was so mad when she got out. And she's why'd you do that?
I'm
like,
don't get it.
I don't know. I thought it would be funny. And she goes, no, she really thought I was stealing stuff.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, no, I thought she knew I was joking. She's like, no, she didn't. And I was like, I don't know. And then I was like, all right,
I was threatened and then eventually sued by a heckler several years
really?
Ago. Yeah, it was a disaster of a story. Too long. We only have 15 minutes left, and this is supposedly about you, Jeff Cerulli. By the way, who has – it's C-E-R-U-L-L-I, and it's and Jeff is with a J, J-E-F-F. And that's his Instagram. He has a new special, Live at the Bomb Shelter. It's on Amazon, Apple, all the streaming stuff. Get out there. Give it a shot. And
was it sued for defamation or some bullshit like that?
Like I hurt his feelings was part of it, PTSD. Ugh. And and the other one was he said that I grabbed his balls.
Okay.
Here's what was happening. He's about 6 inches or so taller than me. And he was backing me up against a wall next to my merch. and I put up my hands and he walked into it and I essentially pushed him, right? As soon as I touched him, I knew red card, right? And so I took myself off. But he kept saying, "You grab my balls." And I tried to lighten the mood, which was not possible, by saying, "I did not, but if I had, look what you're wearing." And he was wearing a suit. So I thought it was obvious that that was a joke.
Yeah.
That cost me 11 grand. Anyway,
oh my God, because so, of lawyer fees?
And settlement.
God, sorry about
it
that.
It was
That's
a lot.
Terrible.
Yeah.
And he heckled you. He started this.
Oh, it was a destination heckle. They didn't even his partner was wearing a Trump hat. I wasn't even political at the time. And she just wanted to heckle me from the front row for the whole time. And so she whisper heckled me. You ever been whisper heckled where no one else could hear it?
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I look like a maniac. Here's the other thing I do call people a Magoo. Hey, Whitey Magoo, keep it together. And, or I'll say, you're being a smarty Magoo. That's why I just posted how my sister, got to be in, Barron's because she's a smarty Magoo.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have so gone off, but the idea of a documentary going forward. So wait, so what was Hungry about? That was my original question.
Competitive
10
eating.
Ago.
It was about competitive eating. And it was the year Kobayashi, the most famous eater at the time, the Japanese guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Went to Nathan's hot dog eating contest on the 4th of July and he got arrested. And I was always enamored by the contest. I always thought the spectacle of it was so interesting that it's like,
right.
You know the saying, like a hat on a hat? It's like, it's not a hat on a hat because they have the eating, which is ridiculous, right? Like it's this ridiculous thing, but then the hosts take it seriously. They can't make fun of it because then it's a hat and a hat. So they're taking it seriously. So I'm like, there's the balance there. It's just so interesting. So we dove in when he got arrested. We're like, we have to do something on this. Let's see. We had no idea how it would end. We're like, let's just talk to as many people as we can. So yeah, we started filming Kobayashi. We got some other eaters involved. There was a controversy where the owners of Major League Eating, the sport, didn't want Barry and myself to talk to any of their eaters. And so we had that angle. And then we were eating ourselves. We were doing competitive eating contests because we thought it would be compelling as two outsiders trying it. And then none of that made it into the film because we were just like, well, we have the characters here. We don't people know competitive eating is hard. You don't need us fucking noobs to be like, oh, wow, I didn't know it was so hard. These guys are struggling. So we did a few hot dog eating contests and other stuff. And it was just a really good experience. And that is what I kind of want to do again when I figure out whatever the next thing is. Tasteless was just interviews. I stand by it. I like it. But I want to do something like that again. Following people around, compelling story. Make it look good,
Right. What would you ever do? Let's see. It was sort of documentary, or it was shot as a documentary. I thought it was called A Day in the Life of a Mexican documentary. And A Day in the Life of a Mexican. Nope. I saw it and it was a one joke premise and it wasn't a documentary, but it was shot. It had so much information in it.
It was called A Day in the Life of a Mexican?
Yeah. But it might be called that, but what it was is about a day where all the Mexican, everyone of Mexican ancestry disappears from California.
Okay.
And the one joke is, of course, replayed over and over and over again because of the sheer enormity of the effect of the Mexican community on the income and economy of California. Just like strollers rolling into the street and nobody washing cars and, this type of thing. But then as the movie went on, because it was the sort of one joke premise, there's one Mexican woman who's left. And there is a spoiler thing on the end of it, so I won't tell you if we ever find out the actual name of the movie. But because she's left and she's like, why wasn't I taken? So she's interviewed by everybody. Why wasn't she taken? And the documentary part of it was to create this very simple narrative of something that was just sort of absurdist.
Yeah.
And then using like talking head news, essentially the news narrative about it. And then eventually, as the movie goes on, more and more numbers show up on the screen. It's just like the income of California. California is like the fourth biggest economy in the world. Mexican contribution to that is something like 78%, and it just like it just sped up and sped up. And it was really beautiful the way they did it. And nobody cared about that movie, by the way. I saw it with 100 other people, and I think it went right to DVD. But it was also from the early 2000s, I think 2005 or 2006, I think. And it was such an interesting sort of melding of documentary and narrative, which I think is a really... Would you ever want to do something like that?
Yeah.
Are there other examples of that? I don't even know.
I guess like the American Animals one that I talked about that mixes narrative and documentary. Like there's ways to blur it. It's just very challenging. But like if you could do something interesting that way, Errol Morris did one called Wormwood that was kind of a little like that. He was obviously another very like famous one. That like sometimes you've seen actors sometimes like docs get away with like if they have like legit like reenactments are one thing, but they'll have like reenactments with actors. Like he did Wormwood, which like it was on I think Netflix a few years ago. It was pretty solid, but he would have like actors like recreating scenes and doing stuff like that. And like you don't really see that too often. It's hard to pull off in a way that's not like cheesy.
Right. It looks pretty cheesy. There's a sort of historical food shows that do that. That stick like a guy in a pair of overalls and some woman in a giant dress. And they're like, here, try to build a fire and slaughter a pig. And it is, I mean, I'm fascinated, but we didn't need the outfits. but I like the idea of mixing those two things just because other like, because music documentaries are usually end up being like, sometimes those can end up being big ads for whoever, like the Taylor Swift one, like the Rolling Stones was famously done by Scorsese.
Scorsese did the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. And you're just like, it's just a love letter.
Yeah.
To Fran Lebowitz every time, he's like, I think she's great. We're going to talk more to her about her opinions.
He loves her.
And you're like, he loves her. I think she's hilarious. Wouldn't invite her to the house. She sounds like a bit of a pill.
Yeah.
But I do love, I think she's hilarious. And maybe when the cameras aren't pointed at her. Did you ever see the documentary with, about Madonna that had Warren Beatty?
Yeah. Truth or Dare. That was an interesting one. The Metallica one was interesting. Truth or Dare was interesting. Like those were kind of like offbeat. Like that wasn't, that it felt like it had something in it that you'd want to see that wasn't just like this band so awesome.
Right. It didn't feel so much like it. It feels like it was a love letter, but it was a love letter to someone who's genuinely flawed.
Yeah.
Is what Truth or Dare felt like to me. Because I liked Madonna. I was age appropriate for it. But there was a line in it where Warren Beatty, like the director, says they were fighting. And the AD or somebody goes, do you want us to turn the cameras off? And Warren Beatty goes, don't be ridiculous. She doesn't want you to turn the cameras off. And I was like, ooh, sick burn. So
I remember the scenes with her dad.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I remember that one. That was good. Did you watch the Shandling documentary?
No. Is that great?
Excellent. Yeah. It was the guy. So it's funny, like, the Nirvana documentary, I'm going to mix comedy and music here. The Nirvana documentary that came out maybe like 10 years ago was really good. And it was edited in such like a specific like way, this like really like high quality, like mixing of like notes and footage. And it was just edited in such like a amazing way. And then I saw the Gary Shandling one maybe like 5 years ago. And I was like, this, you know, this really reminds me of the Nirvana one. This just has like the same feel. It was the same fucking editor. I looked at it after. I go, oh, it's the same editor. Yeah, they wanted the Gary Shandling one. They're like, we want this to be Nirvana. Let's get the guy. Because it's edited in such a specific way that it was like, the Shandling one's really, it's really offbeat. And like, because they take his like note, they take like his notes, like the it was called like the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. So they take like his diary entries, his journal, his words, and they kind of edit it in a way of like, you know, old clips. And like, it's just, yeah, the Nirvana one, I forget what it was called now. It was the one that came out in 2015 or whatever. Very similar. They're both excellent.
Yeah. I would probably watch that. My mother-in-law is watching comedy specials 4 to 6 hours a day.
Why?
She lives with us. Cause she's very frail.
Okay.
And I think she's trying to bond with me, and what she's really doing is triggering. As much as I love stand-up comedy, but I've gotten to see a lot of great stand-up comedy and some fairly mediocre. I was like, how did you even find Dry Bar? And then Lori Kilmartin came over and said, why hasn't she seen mine? And I said, I don't know. I'm not curating it. And Chris goes, Lori tells her that, tells Chris, my mother-in-law, that it's on Amazon. And she's like, oh, I didn't even know there was comedy on Amazon. Well, Jeff Cerulli's is. That you should know. It's on Amazon. It's called Live at the Bomb Shelter. And so is Lori's. It's called, I think it's either Corset or Cis Woke Slut.
She's
something.
So great.
And she's an amazing, amazing comic.
I remember when I used to see it at New York Comedy Club watching Lori in like 2005. I remember that place was a fucking zoo back then. It was terrible. Now it's like, it got bought out like 6 years ago. It's now one of the better clubs in the city. But back before, it was the old owner, and it was just, it wasn't run.
It was just a mess.
Well, yeah. So yeah, do you remember it?
Yeah.
I have a good Gaffigan story if you'd like it.
Because he came and did it. Let's hear it.
Okay. So I would watch Lori Kilmartin. This is like 05. So it was the guys that were doing on Saturday night were like Lori Kilmartin, Andrew Kennedy, Russ Meneve, Buddy Bolton. Do you remember Buddy Bolton?
Never met him. Okay. Okay.
Local so it was guy? Like this era. So Gaffigan was still doing it, but this was kind of the end of him doing it. He's done. So it was the guy who managed on Saturday nights. I would work there. He would throw me up.
Right.
And he wasn't supposed to, but he liked me. And a year later, he's like doing real estate. And that's just kind of how it goes. You get someone who likes you in the business and then they move on to something else.
Yeah.
So he would throw me up on Saturday nights. And this crowd is particularly rowdy this Saturday nights. New York Comedy Club, it's rowdy. I'm like a year into comedy, so I can't handle rowdy crowds really well.
Right.
So I'm on stage, I'm kind of struggling. And then this girl basically sexually harasses me, is like, take it off, which is something that a guy would do to a girl, but I'm getting it done. And then all the women are like, take it off. And I can't handle it. Like I can handle it now. Like I would be funny about it, but I'm like a year in comedy. So I'm like fumbling and whatever. And then I get
embarrassed and going,
yeah.
Wait,
I'm
do
like,
you,
can I just tell my jokes, please? Please.
Can I just tell my jokes, please? Which always works.
And I get off stage and Gaffigan goes, does this happen to you every show? You're going to get laid, man. And then he goes up. First line he says, he goes, I'm so happy to be here performing for you morons. And that was kind of it for him there. He probably did another few months and then he was like, you know, doing theaters or whatever. But it was like the end of him doing the shitty rooms in around the city.
What I love about Gaffigan and Lori is the willingness to do any shitty room.
Yeah.
Sometimes she'll call me and I'm like, where are you going? She's like, I was driving an hour and a half to make $100. And I was like, why? She's like, well, they'll give me 30. And I'm like, oh, I wish I were you and I'm glad I'm not. How about that?
Yeah.
But she does light a fire under me. So someone should do a documentary about Lori Kilmartin. That's what I say. Though I think they did a little bit with her dead dad stuff, the 45 jokes about my dead dad. I think there's a documentary part to it.
Yeah.
About her in her stand-up where they interview like Patton because there were people who she live tweeted her dad's death and it had never been done and Twitter was relatively new. And
yes.
she ended up getting like a boat ton of followers, and it was very sad. She's still sad about it. My mother died a long time ago. I'm over it. Wow, such a dick. Here's the thing, you guys. We have been talking. It's been an hour. Jeff Cerulli is a great guy.
It's a lot. It's a lot. I get it.
It's a lot.
I'm sorry your mom passed.
Well, that's very nice. My dad is hard on moms. Both of them are dead. But he still lives. And so he's plugging along. And you seem like a very nice man. Jeff and I, we've met in person, but I can't. It's been a while.
Yeah.
So you guys find him. Tell him what a good person he is, but laugh at his jokes, because it's live at the Bomb Shelter on Amazon and Apple and all the streamers. Jeff Cerulli, J-E-F-F-C-E-R-U-L-L-I. Thank you so much for doing the Dork Forest. This was actually fascinating, so I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on and complaining about docs and loving them, but also wishing they were overall in a better spot.
And yet, there's gems out there. Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
Al, how was the show?
Well, it was super fun. It was with a New York comic. I was, because I'm looking at his name. It's Jeff Cerulli. Oh, okay. I wanna pronounce it right, because I don't know him. He's a New York comic. And I think his handle is just at Jeff Cerulli. Yeah, he's a comic. He has a new special out, Comedy Dynamics special, called Live at the Live at the Bomb Shelter. That's it. But he did a documentary. And he loves documentaries.
He made one himself?
Yeah, he's made, I think, two documentaries. And one was about eating contests, like hot dog eating contests and stuff. And that's the one that was more successful. But he loves just the idea of documentaries. And we talked about many different documentaries. He wants to like everyone's documentaries, but some documentaries drive him nuts because they're just sort of like a big PR ad. And they're not old. He likes old school documentaries.
Likes old school documentaries that aren't there to sell you something.
Right. I guess like the Michael Jordan one was pretty much just Michael Jordan had final say on it. Taylor Swift had final say on hers.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So it wasn't like a documentary. And I tried to remember the name of the documentaries I saw. I got Out of the Celluloid Closet. I think I misnamed that during the show. I think it's Out of the Celluloid Closet. I think I just called it Out of the Closet, which is the name
which
of
is
a
the
thrift
clothing store in West Hollywood. Right.
Right. And Dog Boy and Z-Town. Z-Town and Dog Boy. Or Dog Town and Z-Boys.
Yeah, that's right.
So
One of those two.
Yeah, I haven't watched a lot of documentaries, but I like them.
No, we just watched that Ladies of Rock.
Oh, and that was and he talked about that. He talked about how some of them are episodic. They're not movies anymore.
They're
documentary series.
Yeah. Because there's a market for that now with all these streaming services for shows like that, which is kind of cool.
But I only remember documentaries from when I was a kid where they were like volcanoes and lions and actually,
Of documentaries that get shown to kids.
Okay. And then now as I age, I'm more and more interested in Rick Steves Europe.
Right. I mean, those are documentaries, right?
Right. You know, and we didn't.
Honestly, cooking shows are documentaries.
Yeah, I don't know what I meant to ask him about the difference between sort of reality television and documentaries and sort of docuseries and like all the different things. But it was a fascinating dive into a very specific kind of documentary. So there'll be other episodes. People love all different kinds of documentaries.
And people are now listening to a lot of documentaries as podcasts. Like a lot of the
informative,
really popular podcasts are like the true crime podcasts are basically documentaries.
Right. And sort of history recreation or history taken and then made applying it to current times. Yeah. I love information and I love.
People do. Our brains love it. Our brains crave it.
Wait, what else do we crave?
Brains.
That's a different episode. Would have been zombies. Jeff Cerulli. It's a C E R
ULLI. And he's a great comic and a New York comic. So you can watch his special on all the streamings like Amazon and Apple and all that stuff. So it was a great episode, though. Super fun.
Yay. Oh,
and you know the rules out there, Rangers. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?